All right. So, hi everyone. My name is Joe Pastor. I'll be your host for today's event. We're really excited that you all are here. I'm joined by Rob and Molly, and I'll tell you a little bit more about them in just a moment. But first, I just want to tell you a little bit about what to expect from today's event. Today is really special because this is our first ever Top 10 talk. And today, of course, as you know, we're covering PHAs. We do plan to make this a recurring series. So if you like what you hear today, let us know what you'd be interested in hearing in the future. We've got some ideas for you. These are meant to just be short and sweet, but very useful talks. So they shouldn't take more than an hour of your day. We'll spend about half the time presenting our top 10 most important things that we think you should know from our years working with clients on these different aspects of PSM and RMP. And then we'll allow time to address any questions that either came up during the presentation or those that you pre-submitted during your registration. So that's kind of what to expect there. If you do have questions that come up while Rob and Molly are going through the content, absolutely put it in the chat and I'll make a note of it and we'll get to it at the end. So without further ado, welcome to our top 10 talk on amplifying your PHAs. All right, so your presenters today are Rob Bartlett and Molly Myers. So Rob Bartlett is the co-founder of Amplify Process Safety with more than 25 years of experience in industry related to process safety and risk management. He has facilitated more than 100 PHAs in his career, including WHATIF, HAZOP, and Layers of Protection Analysis, or LOPA. He received his Bachelor of Science degree in Chemical Engineering from Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. So thanks for being here, Rob. All right, and then we also are joined today by Molly. Molly Myers, professional engineer, is a senior process safety consultant with Amplify. She is a licensed professional engineer in both Missouri and Texas with over 30 years of experience as a chemical engineer. She has over 13 years of experience specializing in process safety management. Molly has facilitated a multitude of PHAs for different industries, commodity and specialty chemicals, pharmaceuticals, commercial bakeries, renewable energy. Throughout her career, Molly has also presented and published information on process safety topics at national conferences and trade magazines. She received both her Bachelor of Science in Chemical Engineering and her Master of Science in Engineering Management from Washington University. All right, here we go. We're going to start with our top 10 tips for PHAs. So here we go, number one.
All right, I've been tasked with starting here. So the first kind of top 10 tip that we have for important things for PHAs is to make sure that you choose your facilitator wisely. Our experience, or my experience in particular, is that the facilitator really needs to bring the experience related, obviously, to the methodology. But the important thing is that they also have experience using it. So what we run into sometimes is people who have been trained in the methodology, maybe they went to a CCPS course, or maybe they went to, you know, Primatech or someone like that. But they don't do many, PHAs. They maybe they do one every couple of years, or maybe they do some smaller ones as part of MOCs or something. So we got to make sure that they're trained the technology. And we also want to make sure not just that they're trained, but that they have enough experience to be able to give the process a good PHA. Obviously, industry experience counts. If you have somebody who is fresh out of college, they probably aren't the best person to have as a facilitator. They just don't have the breadth of knowledge about what can happen in whatever particular industry you're in. What are the types of failures that you can have? They may not have adequate experience using the methodology. And then the other one that we like to bring up, obviously, is a fresh set of eyes. And this is where if you have somebody who's doing a PHA who is in the process itself, then they probably are going to do, they certainly can do a fine job with that. But there is a benefit to having an outside set of eyes come in and be able to kind of take come in from the outside and see things that those who are embedded in the process day in and day out don't necessarily see. So choosing your facilitator wisely is the first one, the first of our top 10. So let's go to number two, Molly.
All right, thank you. The next item for consideration is that you really need to pay attention to your documentation. That's going to be key to doing your PHA. Having your process safety information compiled ahead of time is one of the requirements. And that's for a very good reason, because if you don't have good information, it's going to be one of the cases of garbage in, garbage out. You'll be making too many assumptions and you're not going to have a reliable analysis. Start with accurate P&IDs. That's the basis for the whole PHA. That's what you're going to spend most of your time reviewing. So that needs to be as accurate as possible. You need to understand your chemical hazards, which typically comes from your safety data sheets. So you need to look over those ahead of time. And then you also need to be familiar with all of your design information, predominantly on your equipment. What is your maximum allowable working pressures? What is your volumes? What sort of instrumentation do you have? How does it work? Sometimes different types of level devices may have different failure modes, so being familiar with that is essential. Also understanding the design basis for your relief devices that you have, so that you know before you list that as a safeguard for, say, an overfilling scenario, you need to make sure that your relief device is actually sized for that particular scenario. So again, documentation is key to a good study. You need to have your process safety information compiled ahead of time in order to have the team ready to give you a good outcome. So turn it back over to Rob for point number three.
Okay, so for this one, the methodology matters. So we want to make sure that we select the methodology that is appropriate. It's an appropriate fit for the process complexity. So as I'm sure you can imagine, you know, as a consulting company in process safety, we get all sorts of different processes. Different companies come to us asking for assistance. And what we see sometimes is that we've got companies who in the past have tried to use kind of the wrong methodology for the type of process they have, and it kind of goes both ways, where you see a company that has a very complex process with a vast number of unit operations and all sorts of different chemical hazards and changes of state and all that, and they think that a what if analysis is going to be a good fit for that process. Per OSHA and per EPA, sure, you can use a what if, but it's not the best fit. So you want to make sure that we've got, and also going the other way, people who have very simple processes that are per company policy have to use HAZOP or some other more complex methodology, when really all they needed is a what if or maybe even a checklist. So make sure you select the methodology that best fits the process complexity. This next one is a little bit new for some companies out there. And this is basically our guidance here. Lean towards semi-quantitative assessments where you can, and obviously where it's appropriate. And what do I mean by semi-quantitative? Well, back in the, back when we were first doing PHAs, everything was very subjective. How the failure rates for causes were, how often do you think this is going to happen? And the safeguards were very much list your safeguards. Does that seem like it's adequate to reduce the risk? Sure. Okay, well, we don't need any more recommendations. What we prefer to do is bring in kind of the failure modes that come from the LOPA methodology where you're actually looking at probability of failure on demand. You're looking at failures of equipment based on industry data. And a lot of larger companies are doing that or have been doing that over the last 5 or 10 years. And I think that's a better way to go. It kind of takes it out of the fully subjective arena and kind of at least gets a little bit of quantitative assessment thrown into it. And the last thing is use checklists where appropriate. You know, that could be, as most of us do, human factors and facility siting checklists as part of our the way that we address that in the requirement that OSHA and EPA have. There also are other checklists, you know, whether it's ammonia refrigeration or warehouse operations or lab operations. Companies have and industry groups have put together checklists that many times are the most appropriate way to assess the hazards. And another one that comes to mind is if you're an industry that has a particular standard, consensus standard, like propane has NFPA 58 that lists all sorts of requirements. Hey, there's a checklist that allows you to kind of go through and assess your process. So the method that you choose does matter. Make sure that you choose the right one for that. And that's, if you do that, that's going to give you a better odds of having a good PHA. Okay, Molly, on to you for the next one.
So another item that you need to deal with before you jump into your PHA sessions is figuring out how to break down your process into nodes or small enough groups for the team to handle. So you want to break your process into study nodes, and you want to make these not too big, not too small, kind of like Goldilocks. You want to look for just the right size. Too big would be if, say, you have a lot of pieces of equipment, lots of unit operations. You don't want to group all those together. Too small is when you break pieces of equipment apart that are really interrelated. For instance, if you've got a distillation column, you don't want to segregate out your reboiler or your condenser into separate nodes. One way to check to make sure that you're on the right track is if you can describe your process intent for that individual node in, you know, a couple sentences, you're probably on the right track. If you need to go on for an entire paragraph to talk about what is happening in there, it's probably too big. If there really isn't much to say about what happens, if you've got one single piece of pipe in your node, it's probably too small. So be like Goldilocks, look for something that's not too big, not too small. Another approach is looking at process steps. So sometimes if you've got a batch process, dividing your nodes into process steps. For instance, you may have a reactor and process step one is your initial charging, loading, and then maybe you have a heating step and that's another node. So batch processes are a little bit different, but overall, really pay attention to your nodes because that could make or break the study and make it either really easy for the team to handle or too big and they can choke. So back to you, Rob, for number five.
Yeah, and before I go on to number five, you know, there's also, you know, the case where you get into the PHA and you think that you have the nodes right and you get into trying to assess it, a particular node, and you realize like, okay, we totally got this wrong. Modify what you're doing and just move forward. So there's no right or wrong. It's just what's going to work for you. And sometimes you figure that out late in the game, but better late than never. Okay, going on to number five is valuable members make a valuable team. So the team that you bring into the room for your PHA is vital. Why do we want to have cross? Why does OSHA want us to have an EPA? Why do they want us to have, you know, cross-functional teams? Why is it important to have? Well, the only, you know, what are we doing? We're brainstorming, right? We're looking at our process and we're saying, okay, what bad things can happen? And the more the composition of the team, and not just the job titles, but the actual people that are in the room with you as a facilitator, is very important to really figuring out what's that brainstorm list of bad things, you know, of things that can go wrong, and then what will the consequences be. So for that reason, we always try to include an experienced operator. There's lots of, you know, evidence that any of us in industry know that the people who know the process best are the people that operate it day in and day out. You know, us engineers, process engineers, or maybe supervisors, we know how things are supposed to work, but we don't necessarily know what things are like today out in there. We know how things were designed to work, don't necessarily know how they're working today. So having an experienced operator is vital. And they don't always like the prospect of having to be involved, but I will say that it is rare that I have a PHA where the operator that we have in the room with us doesn't come out of it saying, wow, that was great. I really learned a lot. And I'm glad I participated. So include an experienced operator. Ensure everyone is participating. This is certainly a challenge. And when you do PHAs remotely, it's even more of a challenge. But it's something that's important, right? We have multiple people in the room because we want to use their expertise. And if you have one or two people, especially if they're management or like senior engineering type, they tend to be a little bit more domineering in a meeting like this. So we want to make sure that we've got everybody participating. Touch base with the operator who hasn't said anything for a while. Does this make sense to you? Is there something we're missing? Does this work the way it's supposed to work? So make sure everybody's participating. And then manage the meeting to maintain focus. So don't forget that you've got to take breaks. Don't make the day too long. Ban cell phones and other distractions. There's obviously reasons, you know, biological and other to take breaks. But, we all know what at the end, especially in the latter part of a week when we've been doing a PHA all week, Thursday afternoon and Friday can be very, very tough. So part of your job as a facilitator is to make sure that you're managing that. We want to make sure that, you know, at the end, that the PHA that we're doing at the end of the week has the same quality as a PHA at the beginning of the week, or if it's a really long PHA, the PHA that we started, you know, 3 weeks ago, and we're now on like, you know, week three or week four. We want to make sure that we're managing that energy to make sure that we're not kind of just kind of getting into like, oh God, we just have to get this done. So those are some thoughts about the team itself. And now Molly's going to talk about risk.
Yep, thank you. So before you start your PHA, you need to have your risk matrix already predefined. You don't want to be in the middle of the meeting and then be trying to make a decision, is this risk acceptable or not? So set that criteria before you jump in so that you're not skewing your answers. You need to figure out what types of consequences you're going to be concerned about. Now for OSHA, obviously you want to be concerned about safety consequences. For EPA, you want to be focused on environmental consequences. So just about all PHAs will have categories for safety and environmental. Sometimes companies may want to try and include monetary types of consequences, business interruption, equipment damage, so forth. Some companies say, nope, we are not going to bog our team down with looking at those other types of consequences. We're going to focus on the safety and environmental. So it's very important to consider, what are you going to be looking for and what does the team need to be concerned about? Then you need to set up your rules for your risk categories so that you know, if I end up with a consequence of a 3 and a frequency of a 1, is this acceptable risk? Is this a type of risk that we have to have a recommendation for? Is this a type of risk that's acceptable, but we'd prefer to minimize it if possible, and the team should try to come up with recommendations if it makes sense? So all of that should be predefined before you jump into your PHA sessions. You need to make sure that your time horizon for your frequency makes sense. For your consequences, worst case, you're going to be talking about catastrophic losses, fatalities, major releases, vapor cloud explosions, things of that sort. And you want to make sure that your time horizon goes out quite a distance. You don't want to be saying, oh, well, nobody can really comprehend anything longer than 100 years, so we'll limit our frequency to 100 years. And then what do you do when you end up with a consequence of multiple fatalities? Sometimes you can't get the consequence to go lower. You have to address that by reducing your frequency. If your time scale only goes to once every 100 years, you don't want to be having a team saying, yeah, we'll accept a fatality every 100 years. That's not really going to float. So watch your time horizon on your risk matrix, and then make sure that your risk tolerance matches what your company is interested in, and that you're not wasting your team's time. So I talked a little bit about the worst case consequences. By the same token, on the other end of the spectrum, you don't want to be saying, oh yeah, if we have a first aid injury once every 10 years, that we have to have a recommendation. Well, a first aid injury every 10 years might not be that bad, and maybe the team should focus on other types of risk. So watch that whole risk matrix, make sure that it's acceptable before you jump in with your team. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Rob for number 7.
All right. So we talked a little bit about frequencies. Let's talk about consequences. Always remember, we're trying to ask, when we talk about consequences in a PHA, what's the worst that can happen? We want to make sure that the consequences are worst case, assuming safeguards don't work. There are some types of situations where it may be okay to say that one or more safeguards are acceptable to consider in your worst case. But for the most part, just assume that you're looking for worst case without any safeguards. And you'll get tired of saying over and over again, reminding people, no. In this step, we're talking about what's the worst that can happen without safeguards, and then we'll talk about the safeguards in place later. That wouldn't happen because the pump interlock would shut it off. Well, that's a safeguard. We got to focus on what happens if that doesn't work. So what's the worst case? Focus consequences on factors outlined in the risk matrix. Remember that we're a PHA, we haven't really said it here, but a PHA is a balancing act between, you know, the time that we're taking and the actual risks that we're looking at. And we want to make sure that we're focusing only on those things in the risk matrix. So in other words, if all your company policy requires is that you look at the safety consequences, don't spend a lot of time talking about what the dollar value would be of damage from the vapor cloud explosion or something. And the last thing that we have here is establish wording for ending scenario review if there are no consequences of concern. And this goes back to documenting consequences, which I think we had a question about this later on in the Q&A, but you always want to make sure that you document why do you think that there's not going to be a consequence of concern when you're doing your worst case, and make sure that that's documented, because at some point someone's going to come around, whether it's OSHA, EPA, an internal auditor, or even the next PHA team. And if all you've said is no issues or no consequences of concern, and there's nothing else there, it's very hard to reconstruct what the team was thinking if you don't have enough information. Okay, number 8, Molly, you're going to talk about operator responses.
Yeah, so operator response is often tossed out as a safeguard. Okay. And in some cases, that makes a lot of sense, but not in all cases. So you need to really think about, what are you expecting that operator to be doing? Keep in mind that they're going to need to do some troubleshooting. if you're talking about significant problems and deviations, they could be getting a lot of alarms all coming in, and they're going to have to decipher what is the starting point, what's the first one, what's the main one that they need to address. So give them some time to do that. And then they're also going to need to figure out what's their response. Hopefully that's spelled out in your operating procedures. Hopefully they've been trained on that. But there's still a little bit of time to figure out what are we going to need to do. So typically, I've seen the requirement of 10 to 30 minutes between the first alarm and when you could actually end up with your worst case consequences. If you've got that much time for the scenario to evolve, then it makes sense for an operator to respond. If you're talking about a liquid full system and pressure's building up, you're going to have seconds. You're not going to be able to have an operator respond in an effective manner. Correct. Right. Yep. And then one last thing to think about is if the cause for your scenario is an operator error, then you probably don't want to be counting on your operator as your safeguard, because obviously they are distracted or otherwise not paying attention like they should. That was the cause of the deviation. So you really don't want to count on them having it together to respond appropriately. So be careful on operator response when you call that out as a safeguard.
And we see that all the time. We see companies that are putting in past PHAs, putting operator response to an alarm or some sort of process state, and they're not thinking that all the way through. So don't rely on that.
Right. So, all right, next up is number 9 about the finish line.
So once we get done with our worksheets, we're done, right? We do our report, we're finished. No, that is not the case. Now this is an area that, you know, as outside consultants, we generally don't get into this. We certainly help we help clients along the way, but you know, as a company, you need to make sure you do the post PHA things right, because otherwise, what's the purpose of doing the PHA? So make sure that your recommendations are specific. Don't have your recommendations, you know, just say improve safeguards for this. Like, that's not enough. What you got to remember is that the recommendations are going to be taken from the report and put on a list somewhere, whether that list is Excel, whether that list is some internal database. That recommendation is going to be separated from the report and separated from the worksheets. So the more, as facilitators, the more specific we can make those recommendations, so that when they copy paste there, it still retains a certain amount of the information that you had in your worksheets. That's just going to be better for you to make sure that when the project engineers implements a project to address the recommendation, that they're actually doing the right thing. Because I've gone back through an audits and found where that wasn't the case. Like, oh, okay, so you say you closed this, but that action doesn't actually address what the PHA was concerned about. So that's number one. Manage your claim safety critical safeguards. So we have worst case incidents. We have safeguards that are preventing those worst case incidents. So those safeguards are critical for the safety of the operation. We've got to manage those properly. We've got to use RAGAGAP, recognized and generally accepted good engineering practices, to make sure that we are managing those. Are we inspect? We've got to make sure we've got the inspections done on those properly. We've got to make sure that if anything's found in the inspection, that they are that they're addressed and they're fixed. We've got to do preventive maintenance. So make sure that all your safety critical safeguards, that you're managing them properly. And the same thing for administrative controls, for procedures or checklists. You got to make sure that they're marked as such. You've got to make sure that people are trained on doing them. They make sure that if an operator is supposed to do something to respond to that particular high level alarm, we have to train them what that is. And we've got to make sure that they know that we know it. We've got to communicate the findings to affected personnel, generally operators, maintenance folks, engineers, supervision, whatever. And this isn't like, here, read the report. This is, you know, sometimes it's a PowerPoint presentation, sometimes it's a discussion in like some sort of site-wide meeting, but we all want to make sure that we're giving, hey, generally, these are the hazards that we have. Here are some of the really bad scenarios that could happen. Here are some of the safeguards that are particularly important for us to make sure that we operate this safely. You need to communicate that to meet the requirements, and you want to make sure that's documented. And then, of course, we need to maintain the reports for the life of the process. There are a lot of companies that if you go back, 15 or 20 years to soon after these requirements came out from OSHA, they may not have the PHA from 1997, but they're supposed to. And at least you want to make sure going forward that you have that the plant has those in some sort of central repository. Usually everything's electronic now, so at least it's on the server, on SharePoint or whatever, to make sure that number one, that you're meeting the requirement, and also that people in the future have access to what that group was thinking. So this is a top 10 talk. So I guess we've got one more left to go. So Molly, I'm going to turn it over to you for number 10.
So this last one is all about timing and don't procrastinate. So Rob talked about recommendations and make sure that they're clear. They often get separated out from the PHA report into some sort of tracking system. So you need to make sure that you've got a system set up to make sure that those recommendations are addressed. They need to be done in a timely fashion. So if they're simple, go ahead and take care of them in, a month or two. If it's documentation updates, procedure updates, training, do those sorts of things as quickly as you can. If it's something that's going to take a project, okay, that might take a little bit longer to get funding and get design and equipment and so forth, but have a plan in place. You also need to watch your timing for when the next PHA is coming due. Those need to be done within 5 years. So set up some sort of reminder in case there's some personnel turnover in that intervening time that doesn't slip through the cracks. And so watch your timing. Go ahead and have some sort of system set up for PHA scheduling recommendations. And most places work well to have some sort of tracking system or ongoing review of your recommendations, just to make sure that management's aware that we have X number of these pending, here's our due dates, and make sure that all the resources are committed appropriately to take care of those. So we went through all 10. Joe, you want to do a little wrap up and then we'll see what sort of questions people have?
Absolutely. All right. Thanks, Molly and Rob. So those complete our top 10 tips. So again, choose your facilitator wisely. That is really important. It makes or breaks your PHA. Documentation is key. So make sure you've got the necessary documentation to do it an adequate and thorough PHA. The method matters. Make sure your methodology suits the complexity of your process. Otherwise, it's not adequately going to address your hazards in the process. Create nodes like Goldilocks, so not too small and not too large, in order to get the best analysis. Valuable members make a valuable team. Make sure that you're including and managing your team in a way that is going to give you the best outcome as far as your analysis of safeguards and hazards. Make sure you're including experienced members in operations and across other groups as well, and that you're managing your group well in order to have a good study at the end. As Rob and Molly mentioned, sometimes these PHAs can be really long, and the way that you manage the team can really make a difference in the quality of the study. Make sure you have already established your risk and the risks that you're willing to accept by establishing a risk matrices or a risk matrix rather. And we've actually got a great podcast episode on this if you're interested, just about risk matrices. Make sure when you're considering consequences that you ask what's the worst that could happen with no safeguards to really get the best analysis. Approach operator response realistically if you're going to take credit for it. Molly had some great points about what a reasonable amount of time is when it comes to being able to claim that as a safeguard. Remember that the final report is not the finish line. You're not done. Also, it's a recurring task every 5 years, so don't lose track of that or the recommendations. And then finally, of course, don't procrastinate, especially if you're seeking help from a consultant such as ourselves. We do need time to adequately prep for the best study possible, so don't procrastinate. Honestly, the earlier you can reach out and start prepping for your PHA, whether it's done internally or externally, the better. Mm-hmm. All right. We will move along to our Q&A session. We have not had any questions in the chat so far, but feel free to drop them in there if something comes up. We're going to go ahead and address some questions that were submitted during registration. So I'll go ahead and read one of these for Molly and Rob to respond. So the first question we got is, following the final session of a PHA, but prior to the issuance of a final report, sometimes quality assurance updates are required. Is there any PSM regulatory precedent or ruling or interpretation that restricts the ability to perform these QA updates?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know of any regulatory guidance, but I know from experience that yes, there is a lot of cleanup that's needed on those worksheets. It doesn't make sense to waste the entire team's time fixing typos and minor clarification type things. So after the PHA, that's one of the activities that the facilitator is going to need to do. They need to fix typos. They need to look at the recommendations and make sure that they are correct. Make sure that they have tag numbers referenced, PNIDs referenced. As Rob said, have enough verbiage in there that if it's taken out of context, you know what scenario it's talking about. You don't need to waste the team's time for that type of cleanup during the meeting. But it helps to clean that up afterwards. Also, often during the sessions, I will use abbreviations for things like no safety consequence of concern. I may just abbreviate NSCC. Okay, after the session, I'll want to go through and change all that abbreviation out to actual wording so that somebody later will understand what's going on. So, yes. Cleanup is very typical, but what you want to make sure that you do is just QA, QC type activities. You do not want to change the actual thinking that the team had done. So you're not going to want to add additional recommendations. You're not going to add extra scenarios and things of that sort. But general editing for clarity is definitely advantageous.
So I just want to jump in there and add a couple things. I'm not sure whether the question was worried about timing related to the every 5 years requirement. So, but I think it's probably a question that some people might have is that I've got this requirement that's got to be done every 5 years. And well, what if it takes me like, you know, we do the work sessions, but then it takes me like, you know, a month or two because we've got to clean things up and maybe we have some questions we've got to answer. How do I handle that as far as you know, the 5 year requirement? And I have one client that I think does a very good job of this, and there's no regulatory or interpretation that I've or any guidance that I've seen about this, but I think in my head this makes sense. Basically, they picked a part of the process, a part of the PHA process, and they said, okay, that's what we're going to base our 5 year timeline on. Every 5 years, we're going to be to this point. And what this company does is they do the draft report. So at least every 5 years, that draft report is going to be done. If it takes you a little bit longer to do the QA QC and go through your management review and all that, that's fine. But they're doing it every 5 years with the draft report. The concern that I do have though is that if you use that, okay, fine, but you still got to finish it up in a timely fashion. If you wait too long, now you've got like, okay, so you've met the 5 year requirement, but You haven't implemented any of your recommendations because you're still trying to finalize the report. So there's a bit of a balancing act there, but I do like that approach of pick a part of the timeline and use that as your focus for your 5 years. So, Joe, next question.
Yep, I just wanted to add real quickly. I know that as far as the original question and talking about like certain updates, sometimes a parking lot is used during the study to collect any items that are going to be outstanding that may hold up, you know, the issuance of the draft report. So I think that's a great tool as a facilitator. Is if it's not something that's truly a recommendation, but is something that you need to follow up on in order to help you finalize things on your end, a parking lot is a really good way to keep like a bucket of open items to help you track to completion.
And also just going to jump in there. You made me think of something. Don't put in as a recommendations. Don't put anything in the recommendation that's not actually going to be reducing the risk. So if all right. it is update the tag, this tag number on this PHA, on this PNID, or, you know, improve the procedure or label the valve, whatever. None of those is really like your risk reduction. None of those is a safeguard. Don't make that, put that on your bucket list or your parking lot and keep the recommendations, because if you don't, those recommendations, all of them are going to be treated by regulators as actual recommendations. So if you haven't updated that PNID, that could be that'll be a violation. So,
good point. Okay, our next question is: do you have any advice for facilitators that may not be familiar with the chemical process being analyzed? For example, a corporate PSM engineer is facilitating over multiple chemical processes.
So with that, Rob talked about some of the requirements for the team and the facilitator. So the facilitator's role is to be familiar with the methodology and the team management and the recording, you know, methods of how you document everything. They're not the ones that are frequently expected to be the expert in the process. That would be your operators, your process engineers, and so forth. So the facilitator really just needs to have enough of an awareness of the process to be able to properly divide nodes, or at least make a first stab at that. As Rob said, sometimes you can get into the sessions and you have to make adjustments, but it works most efficiently if the facilitator can pre-divide that before the sessions start. So the other thing that the facilitator needs to be aware of are the chemical hazards. And you can get those from your looking at your SDS ahead of time. So that's easy to do. And then the other thing I would suggest for the facilitator is to look at your process description, which is part of your process safety information, to get a general overview of what you're looking at, how the process is laid out, but you're not expected to be expert in the process.
Yeah, and the only thing that I would add is that, you know, this is where choosing a facilitator who has experience in general experience in the industry and has done this multiple times, a lot of times, helps, because you know, as I've done enough of these where I can go into most, you know, most chemical processes and pretty quickly, you know, between doing the pre-work that Molly already talked about and then getting a tour, you know, the site tour that you probably do before the PHA, you know, that basically gets into my head like enough where I'm able to, although I'm not the subject matter expert, I can play devil's advocate. I can say, well, what about this or what about that from my experience. And as you, as a facilitator, whether you're a corporate engineer within a larger company or whether you're a consultant, you develop that, you know, over time. So the best way to develop it is, you know, is just to practice.
Kind of on that note, Rob, I think it's valuable for someone in that role who's maybe not yet comfortable to facilitate, for them to join the team and really be there during the study sessions so that they can understand the hazard better by participating as part of the PHA team.
Yeah.
All right, we've got a question that came in our chat from Eric. So He said, regarding risk appetite, how do you determine if a company has too large of an appetite for risk, and how do you address that?
Let's see. I think that this is interesting because we, you know, as outsiders coming into companies, often, especially a new company that maybe we haven't worked with before, like I'll get a risk matrix and I'll look at it and I'll say, is this really what they think? Is this really their appetite for risk? And Eric, I think that the only way really to answer that question is that management needs to tell you. I mean, basically, and I've had those conversations with clients, like, you know, when you're putting together, or when you get a risk matrix and they say that it is not acceptable to have, I don't know, Molly, to go off of the example you had earlier about first aids, right? It's not acceptable to have a first aid, say, once every 10 years. Like, none of us want to have a first aid ever. But the fact is that it would cost us too much and have too much time, and we'd never be able to be in business if we first aid proofed every single process. So I've had conversations. Are you sure that is what you really want to do for your risk matrix? Because that's gonna push you into doing recommendations for additional safeguards where you really probably don't really need them. But then going on the other side is like the large sorts of scenarios is it really what you're saying, that it's acceptable to have multiple fatalities once every 100 years? probably not. So I think I don't know, my and Molly, I'll turn over to you, but my response, Eric, is that as consultants or as facilitators, we need to understand what the risk matrix means. And then perhaps if it doesn't feel quite right, have a conversation with management to say, hey, listen, this is what this means. Is this really what we want? Your thoughts, Molly?
Yeah. So what I usually like to do the first time I look at a risk matrix is go to the worst case consequence, usually a fatality, maybe multiple fatalities, and then go down the list of frequencies until I hit the point at which the risk matrix says this is acceptable, or this is acceptable if we can't come up with any other reasonable recommendations. Sometimes there's a kind of a yellow category that's acceptable at the team's discretion. And so I look at that and I say, okay, if I've got multiple fatalities and I go down to whatever that frequency is, say it's 100 years, say it's 1,000 years or something like that, and ask yourself, would the company, management, legal counsel or whatever, be happy with the press getting a hold of saying, oh, they're okay with multiple fatalities once every X years? If you can answer that and say, yeah, that is reasonable, then you're probably okay. If you were to say, oh my gosh, I wouldn't want, you know, the media to get a hold of that, then maybe you're taking on too much risk. So just do a little reality check with that on the high consequence side.
I like that. I like that.
Okay. Next question is asking about guidance for clearly documenting responses to scenarios within the PHA so that others who weren't in the room can better understand the thought process behind the PHA.
Yeah, so good question. So Rob talked a little bit about this with regard to the recommendations and having enough detail. But it's also good to look at the scenarios. So you read them kind of across from left to right, from your deviation or your what if question to your causes, your consequences, your safeguards, and then recommendations if needed. As much as possible, include specific tag numbers or instrument references if a particular valve that you're referencing doesn't have a tag number, isn't labeled. Get the team to help you identify that is the offloading valve or something of that sort. Make sure that you include enough references for that so that somebody picking it up can compare the P&IDs and match them up. Also, under your report, you generally will have copies of your P&IDs highlighted with the nodes, and you can match the node with the worksheets. And so you're looking at that, and then you're saying, okay, I'm looking for equipment V1000. Okay, you pull up the P&IDs, I can see where that is. So take a look, make sure that you put as many tag references as possible on the recommendations, as Rob said. Sometimes it helps to recap the scenario. Add an additional safeguard to prevent vapor cloud explosion in the event of such and such a valve being inadvertently opened or something of that sort. Have enough reference there. So anything you wanted to add to that, Rob?
Yeah, the way that I think of it is as first off, assume that nobody in the room is going to be there in 5 years. So therefore, yeah, if you say failure of PO2 and your consequence is vapor cloud explosion, 5 years from now, nobody's going to remember what that means, let alone, you know, tomorrow. Because those of us in the room, you won't remember, but there are many scenarios that you're, if you document it badly, that you're not going to remember exactly what everybody was thinking. So the way that I like to think of it is tell a story. What's going to happen, right? You know, especially in the consequence section, this is going to happen, and then this is going to happen, and then this is going to happen, and then this is going to happen. And that's going to end up being a fatality, or that's going to end up being an environmental release or something like that. So I think tag numbers are important. Chemicals, you know, release of anhydrous ammonia to the building with, you know, so the more you can tell a story, and is it quicker to just say vapor cloud explosion or, you know, toxic release with fatality? Sure. But you're not doing your job if you leave it like that. And I've had regulators pull up PHAs, let's just say inspectors pull up PHAs that others have done, and I've been forced to defend, saying I don't know what they were thinking when they said that. So that's not a position that you really want to be in.
So Rob, one quick thing to tag on to that is, if you want to explain out that scenario in detail once, and then you come back to that again, that may be a prime example where you don't waste the team's time. You say same as above, or vapor cloud explosion, you know, release vapor cloud explosion. And then subsequent to the meeting, the facilitator can go in and put the rest of that verbiage in there, or you can copy and paste of that detail. Yep.
Copy and paste is your friend.
We did just get a follow-up question from Elliot asking, do you get specific with the safeguards as well?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. Definitely include tag numbers where pertinent, or if you say operator response, say operator response to high level alarm or LHL 1234, be as specific as you can, because otherwise that's open to too much interpretation.
Yeah, and also you got to remember that you're going to want to take the PHA and develop a safety critical safeguard list. And if all you say is rupture disc, you know, you got to know which one. And I would also say add documents as well. If it's operator response to an alarm, what's the alarm tag number? And then what is the procedure number for how they're supposed to respond to that? We talked about that earlier.
Mm-hmm. All right, we've got someone typing another question, but we've got one more that was pre-submitted. Just keep in mind, we've got about 3 more minutes left. We want to be respectful of everyone's time. So this last question that from registration was about operating procedures. So asking, what's the best format now? Is it graphical, tabled with pictographs, mm-hmm. emergency actions laid out, escalation notes? Also, they asked about any advice on the cycle of developing the operating procedures, and asked, should operators develop their own, or should they be done by a specialist and then handed over? And then they also wanted to know about periodic operator validation to execute those. So kind of a big question, but just mm-hmm. what's the best format, and then kind of who should develop them, and then how could they be reviewed over time.
Yeah, so that there's a lot there. I think what we'll do is summarize a lot of these questions and answers and email them out, share them with a lot more detail. But there isn't any standard format, but you need to pay attention to what information you need, make sure that it's laid out logically so that the operators can find what they need quickly, especially when it comes to emergency responses and responding to deviations in the process. The operators should be very involved in the development of the operating procedures. However, sometimes that's best addressed by pairing them up with somebody that can do all the typing and the formatting and all of that. And they're the knowledge base, but they may not be the ones actually writing up the procedures. So, but there's a lot more to it. Well, we can address that separately.
Always involve operators. That's yes. That's my biggest thing. Always involve operators. The format, there's all sorts of different ways to do it. Some are better than others, but if you don't have operators involved, you're probably missing something.
A lot of something.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
Anything else, Joe?
That's our last question. So I'll leave everyone with this slide. We really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for joining us, for registering and sharing it. And sending in your questions. Here's just some ways that you can contact and connect with us. We are very active on LinkedIn and Twitter. So if you prefer either of those platforms, find our company by looking up the information I've put here. You can also email us at info@amplifyconsultants.com if you've got any other questions that we didn't get to today or you think of something. We're always happy to answer any questions related to PSM or RMP. And we'll also send out a recording of this webinar to everyone who registered. So don't worry about that. Check out our website if you're interested in learning more about us and the services we offer or about our team. And then just a reminder, we do have a podcast. We put out episodes about every 2 weeks. We just do this to share information throughout the process safety community. We bring on a lot of different subject matter experts. So there's always something interesting to learn. We've got quite a library of episodes at this point, I think over 50. So feel free to check that out. You can find us on any podcast platform. We're called Amplify Your Process Safety. That's the name of our podcast, and you can find it on our website as well. So with that, we thank you so much for joining.
And Joe, before people go, if you do have any feedback about this, we would sincerely appreciate it. As Joe said when we started, this is the first one of these that we've done. You know, our goal is obviously to get our name out there, but more importantly, our goal is to further our mission, which is to help companies reduce process safety incidents and fatalities by helping them to create world-class process safety programs. And one way to do that is to make sure that folks like us and everybody on the call here have as much information as possible. And a lot of that is information sharing. So that's why we're doing this. If you do have any feedback about the webinar here, whether it's the content, whether it's the format here, or anything that we can do to improve, then please don't hesitate to reach out in one of the ways that Joe lists here. And also, if you did like it, please send it throughout your communities. We'll be doing this again in the future. Topics to be discussed later, but we definitely would appreciate it if you could share our content far and wide, because the more people that are talking about this and thinking about this, the more likely we're gonna save a life out there. So thank you for joining us. I definitely appreciate it. And we'll look forward to seeing you the next time.
Okay. Thanks.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.